the United States. There's plenty of room left in the United States. Plenty of room, but we don't control the room. We don't control how things are organized in terms of the economy. We don't democratically control that. We elect rich people, supposedly, to help in the government to maybe regulate that a little bit. But that's not enough democracy. That's not even close. That's not real democracy anyway. Real democracy would be control. We control the economy. We vote on what's going to be produced, how it's going to be produced, how it's going to be distributed. That would include making sure everyone has a decent job, shorter work week, higher pay, et cetera, et cetera. So the immigrant problem, it's a capitalist problem. And the way we, as socialists, as workers, as union activists, as whoever, just decent people, the way we solve the immigrant problem is that we help migrant workers, we help immigrants become part of our unions, become part of a struggle. And by the way, that's already happening. I mean, there's tons of immigrant workers organizing into unions all over the country, and they actually tend to be, in a lot of cases, more pro-union than the non-immigrant workers. You know, a lot of American workers like myself, who grew up in the post-war upswing, right? Grew up in the 60s and 70s with all the anti-communist, anti-socialist propaganda, with an economy that was doing better in the 50s and 60s, much better actually, than and stronger unions. You know, the American dream had some reality to it to some people. That's gone now. It never really existed for most people, but it was perceived to exist, perceived to be a reality, you know, and that's gone now. You know, that just doesn't really exist. That doesn't mean that nobody is able to work and survive. They are, but at a more precarious level. And I have stats on that, which if we have time, we'll get into, about how, you know, so many Americans are one paycheck away from losing their home. So many Americans are one paycheck from like a emergency. They can't even afford a $400 emergency, you know, that kind of thing. That goes across all sections of the working class, including immigrants. Hits immigrants harder, hits people of color harder statistically, but hits plenty of, white workers, if you want to use that term, as well. Millions that we're talking about. So again, immigrant problem. The problem is capitalism, not immigrants. You know, and if you see immigrants in a workplace and they're not hiring outside of immigrants, that's the boss that's doing that. That's the corporation that's doing that. And so you attack the corporation. The labor movement attacks the corporation, you know, for exploiting immigrants, organizes those immigrants, and then they become part of the union. And then you can open up pressure on other places and get more hiring, fair hiring procedures in place that will not just be the whim of the corporation, the corporate bosses to exploit a certain type of worker, which has been going on since the beginnings of capitalism in this country. There's been a severe divide and rule situation, you know? So you can look back at, say, the building of the railroads. The corporations figured out we're going to hire all immigrant labor from China to build a lot of the railroad in the West. We're going to exploit the hell out of those people. And so some Americans, you know, some workers that are native workers or, you know, it's tricky. The terminology is tricky. I'm not talking about native. Well, it could be Native Americans or other workers. Look at that and say, oh, they're taking our jobs or something. No, they're not taking your jobs. They're trying to survive like everybody else. They could say that about workplaces that don't hire primarily immigrant workers. Say, oh, well, I'm an immigrant worker. All workers under socialism are supposed to be sisters and brothers, equal, right? I'm a socialist. Should I say, well, they're taking our jobs because I see all white workers or non-immigrant workers in a workplace, you know? And I could think of some right off the top of my head. I won't mention them, but that's not fair either. So until we organize together, the unity of the working class is a big principle of socialism. Struggle, multiracial, immigrant status, migrant status struggle is a part of socialism. And unless we unify as much as possible as working people, we will always be divided along different lines, whether it's race, whether it's immigrant status, whether it's other things they think of, gender. They're always out to divide workers. And socialists, good socialists, are always out to unite workers as much as possible. And so that includes immigrant workers. So you know, some of what I'm talking about is happening. It's not just a theory. There are places where immigrant workers, despite having the threat of deportation on their heads, they've organized with non-immigrant workers and organized into unions and won better pay and benefits for everybody. And that's what's got to happen. And where it's not, where they're not, the union movement isn't involved, there's other movements that try to support immigrants. And that's very, very important. We can't let big business divide us. We can't let the corporations divide us based on immigrant or non-immigrant status. That's, you know, borders are things set up by capitalists, and then they create globalization. The capitalists then use, not necessarily create, but they use globalization. They use that as a threat. Hey, you don't do what we want here, you workers in this factory here, we're going to move overseas for chasing cheap labor, cheaper resources, not as much regulation on the environment and all that. We're going to move to China like Apple has done. You know, and what's the answer there? Is it to say, you know, well, yeah, part of the answer is to say you shouldn't do that, but also it's to organize the workers in China, to get the labor movement internationally organized. That's why a lot of unions in this country to this day, if you look at their name, it has the word international in it. Now, what that means practically is they might have some representation in Canada, some union workers in Mexico maybe, and not really international. But that's one of the big things the labor movement needs right now, has always needed, is international links. And you used to have that somewhat through big socialist parties, big labor parties. As those have declined in some places, or they're sort of in the process of changing, new workers' parties, labor parties, socialist parties are coming up, then that can happen through that a little bit. But it's just, it gets thrown back sometimes and has to be rebuilt. And that's a huge thing that has to happen. So basically, if a company says, I'm going to move over to this cheap labor area in China or somewhere, and I'm going to exploit, you know, the lower pay and the government hostile to workers. I mean, China, by the way, is not at all communist. It's been capitalist now for, you know, a couple decades. And the government's hostile to independent unions there, right? Hostile to unions. So the situation is, it's very hard, but it is done. There are people doing it right now. There are people working underground, people working in defiance of the government in China to build independent unions in China. And the more they do so, it's already had an effect. If you read the corporate business media about China, the average pay in China is going up. And part of that is both union and non-union pressure put on the government on pay. And so on. So making those links concrete, really have organizations that go across borders, is extremely important for the labor movement. We can't let them divide us on nationality. I mean, you can't help where you're born. If you really want to think about this on a human level, as a level in terms of empathy and human solidarity, and why should we dislike, as Americans, why should we dislike people that are born in another country? You know, we're all humans, right? And I'm not saying that from a religious or something moral standpoint. I'm saying from a very practical standpoint, you cannot choose where you're born, right? You're born in a country, and you got something in common with a lot, with millions and even billions of people around the world. You got to sell your labor or try to survive. You got to dig out a living somehow as a worker with no capital, with no, you're not part of the 1%. And that's our solidarity. Right there, we start from there, and then we can overcome all the cultural differences, all the attempts by big business, by corporations internationally to divide and conquer. Sometimes based on nationality, well, not sometimes, often based on nationality. You know, Trump, for example, tries to brainwash American workers by saying, "I'm for tariffs, on foreign goods coming in. I'm for, you know, regulations and so on." But when you look at the scope of international multinational corporations and what they do for production and distribution, it goes way, way beyond the little bit that Trump throws out there. And what Trump is doing doesn't really change the situation. He's basically using it as a threat, usually backs off at the last minute, and then there's some sort of a deal worked out that sucks for workers and sucks for people buying those products if they have to. And there's also the situation where another country can easily throw up tariffs, and tariff just means tax on a tax on goods and services going into another country. Even if they throw up a bunch of tariffs, all that does is then it can just go back the other way. And there's disagreement among the big capitalists internationally about that, because they want to exploit labor in other countries. They want to have market share in countries. And if a big tariff gets slapped on, say, their cars or something in a certain country or certain area, they can't sell as many there. So there's all these negotiations happening all the time. Trump didn't invent the tariff thing. There's been tariffs during every presidential administration, big ones, you know, sanctions on all sorts of countries and so on. It didn't fundamentally change anything. Didn't stop globalization. That's been part of capitalism since day one. It's just been that as unions and workers' parties got weaker, and as revolutions didn't succeed or only succeeded for a time, socialist revolutions, then the capitalists regained ground and basically tore up the rule book that everyone thought existed. We have the situation where, there's regulation on foreign trade, and there's rules about how to treat workers, and there's rules about polluting the environment. And they tear up those rules every day, every single day, you know. So I hope that got into what a socialist or a revolutionary socialist would say, a democratic socialist that really wants to change things would say about immigration. But it was a great question, and I liked getting into that. We're talking about Stop and Shop workers, for example, a very mixed, diverse workforce. And that's how most workforces are. I mean, I do know of places that are relentlessly exploiting immigrant labor, and because they just like that extra, big corporations, I'm talking about, that they like that extra threat of deportation. And again, even if you're so-called legal, and I hate those terms, legal and illegal, but I'll use them, or non-legal, I'll use them for a moment. The threat of being mistakenly deported, the threat of focus on your family, and all sorts of other things is still a big threat. The threat of friends that people, coworkers that could be deported, you know. So there are like ICE raids happening on big factories that the corporations populate with all immigrant workers because they want to exploit them more. With that threat of deportation, keep the wages lower and so on. And again, that changes nothing. That's garbage. You know, we're against that as socialists. What happens is that the corporations just buy their time and do the same thing again, find other ways to do their low pay thing. You know, like, for example, like FedEx workers, right? All sorts of people work for FedEx, immigrants, non-immigrants, blah, blah, right? FedEx says, hey, you're all independent contractors. Screw you, you know? And you compare FedEx workers' wages and benefits to like UPS workers that are organized, although they just took a hit with a bad contract. Their union leader, Hoffa, who's useless, I hope they get rid of him soon, accepted a concessionary contract for no reason at UPS workers around the country, for UPS workers around the country. UPS workers doing much better than FedEx workers. UPS workers correctly classified as workers. FedEx workers are workers too, but some sort of, you know, big corporate power game got the common sense and the law thrown out the window, and they're all independent contractors. So that means they don't even get a guaranteed wage necessarily of any sort. But if they do, it can change at a moment's notice, you know. And they technically legally can't organize unions. Although, like with the truck drivers out in the port of L.A., they're fighting that every step of the way. Workers are mostly immigrant. Fighting to unionize with the Teamsters and other unions, perhaps other unions. I think it's mostly the Teamsters. And with a little bit of success, but still fighting government controlled by big business and the corporations that does everything, Democrat or Republican, to hurt unions, especially with the Democrats when, you know, no one's looking or whatever. Republicans are more obvious about it. But believe me, in cities and states controlled totally by Democrats, the all bets are off when it comes to a labor struggle. Now, here in Massachusetts, the Democrats have given, in the legislature, at least some of them have given, verbal support to Stop and Shop workers, which is good, but they're not really putting any pressure, I would bet, on the Stop and Shop bosses, the multinational corporation, to change anything there. So once again, this is WMFO, Medford, WMFO, and Medford Tufts Free Forum, commercial-free, community-based radio. And we're going to take a short musical break here. I don't even remember what I put on here, But yeah, anyway, something by Winter Hours, band near and dear to my heart. And then we're going to experiment with something I didn't even listen to yet and see how that goes. And you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. We'll be right back. Hope you like the music. That was Winter Hours with Longest Century. Winter Hours was a band from upstate New York, where I'm from, back in the late 80s, 89, I think they came out with this album. And I'm not sure, maybe one other album afterwards. Don't know if they ever got back together again, because they split up after that, or stopped producing, I'm not sure which. And just liked it, you know, just liked it. I got this old CD here with I bought it for $2.99 at a place called CD Spins, I guess. I've played it a lot on the show. It's good stuff. All their songs on this album are, if you listen carefully, some of them it's pretty obvious. They're talking about progressive politics, at least. I'd say maybe socialist influenced. Even the songs that don't overtly sound like they're about working class people or politics, they really are if you listen carefully enough. So I really enjoy that album called Winter Hours. And now I think I checked them out on YouTube one time. I think they are on YouTube, but I'm not sure about that. Like a lot of people now, listening to a lot of music on YouTube, but you never know what's available for sure. And we're going to give a public service announcement now, because that's what we have to do. But I kind of like it sometimes. I'm going to go with a non-political public service announcement here, although it is political in a way. Tufts University Art Gallery. The Tufts University Art Gallery is dedicated to conceiving and presenting exhibits and educational programs that explore new global perspectives on art and art discourse. All exhibitions and related programming are free. I got to stress that. Open to the public and fully accessible. I had this thing happen to me recently where I took my family, my kid, including my kids, to that museum out in Salem, Peabody Essex Museum, right? Because there were some exhibits there that looked interesting. So we go out there. It's pretty expensive, and I got some sort of like cheaper ticket, I think, maybe. I'm going to have to remember that clearly. Slightly cheaper ticket from through this thing called Outings and Innings at Harvard University, where I work. And so I got a slightly cheaper ticket, or maybe not. I'm not sure. I can remember the details there. But either way, it was a lot of money. And then I started talking to the people at the desk there. I say, hey, do you guys have like a free day? Like the Museum of Fine Arts has free days, or like in Boston, which that's a huge amount of money to go there. I'm not even plugging that place. But if you do go there, it's free on Wednesdays after 3:45 or something. It's the Bus Museum of Fine Arts. And sometimes they have free days. And I used to take my family to free days. Of course, it's extra crowded then, like Martin Luther King Day or whenever. They have about two or three a year. So I'm like, okay, PBS Museum, do you guys have any free days? Do you guys have any reduced admissions for this or that? You know, and pretty much the answer is no free days. No reduced, and some reduced admission, but just based on like very little reduction and based on age or something. And I'm like, that sucks. But I didn't say that right to their face. I just walked back to my family and said, that sucks. Why put a museum? I don't know if you know Salem, right? But Salem is, a lot of it's pretty working class, despite the attempt to gentrify the downtown area. And who can afford the Peabody Essex Museum? Not a lot of working people. In fact, how many working people even go to art galleries? But this little one here at Tufts is free. All exhibitions related to programming are free, open to the public, and fully accessible. I wish they would use the term fully accessible more than just in terms of people with disabilities, although that's perfectly useful for that. That's great. But fully accessible can mean a lot of other things, too. Tufts University Art Gallery is located in the Eidekman, A-I-D-E-K-M-A-N, Arts Center at 40 Talbot Avenue on the Somerville-Medford campus of Tufts University. For current exhibitions and hours, just search the web for Tufts University Art Gallery, or you can also call 617-627-3518. This has been a public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And I don't know what's up there right now. Like it says, give them a call, or go, or just Google Tufts University Art Gallery. And that is pretty close to the station, actually, right here. Another public service announcement, walking is good exercise. Now, this sounds pretty funny, but I'm going to make a political point about this one. So let's give the straight up public service announcement. Although other physical activities can provide a more vigorous workout, walking is easy. Walkout, see, that's like a job action. Walking is easy, requires no special equipment, and is good exercise for most adults. In urban areas, walking can be an excellent alternative to driving or even taking public transportation. For example, it's just a little over 2.5 miles from the Tufts campus in Medford to Harvard Square in Cambridge. A distance that can be walked in about 45 minutes by a healthy adult. That's actually, they got that true. A mile's about 20 minutes walking. Walking can get you fresh air, exercise, burn calories, save you money, and with all the inattentive and otherwise impaired drivers on the road, it's safer than riding a bike. In some places, it's safer than riding a bike. You got to watch out. You got to watch out when you're walking, too. I mean, I drive a lot. I walk a lot. I do all that stuff. I take public transport a lot. Going, getting around a lot. Okay, so what I see happening a lot now as a driver is people walking into crosswalks without looking. They got their headphones, they got their little earbuds in or whatever, or they're just feeling entitled and they walk into any kind of crosswalk without looking. Horrible, horrible, horrible idea. Because that you're assuming by not looking is that the cars and trucks, especially the trucks, see you. Don't assume that. You're also assuming that there are no circumstances where you can just stop for a second and let a car or truck go by. So for example, I work Central Square, Cambridge, and there's this one crosswalk during rush hour that you could just have people consistently going across it, and then you wait there holding up traffic for 20 minutes, and not one pedestrian will give a crap. Same is true for bike riders. Well, you got to give a crap. You got to let the cars through sometimes, you know? Bike riders, for example, like to play the victim all the time, and yet every day I drive, I see bike riders blowing through red lights, blowing through stop signs, almost hitting people sometimes, and acting like the worst drivers, as if they were in a car. Just because you're in a bike and you can't do as much damage doesn't get you out of the, you know, system of rules that we need to survive as people, you know, driving these things, cars, bikes, and other things, motor scooters, blah, blah, blah. But anyways, that wasn't my whole point. My point here is, yes, walking is a good thing. This is a public service message from WFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio. But I want to add, as an editorial comment, not reflecting Tufts Community Radio, is that if you want us as working people to walk and exercise and all that, then you got to do a couple things. We need a shorter work week with no cut in pay so we have time to develop our bodies. Like a lot of other people, I'm overweight. Why? Because between working, commute, taking my kids to places, and all that, there's very, very little, almost no time to exercise. And when there is time to exercise, there's a million other things pressing to get done, like yard work, housework, again, kids, do things for the kids, all that kind of thing. Cook, clean, do dishes. We don't even have a working dishwasher because we can't afford to get the thing fixed that we had when we moved into a place. So come on. You want us to exercise, doctors, and all you people that lecture us on TV about exercise? Then you got to make a time for us because we can't. We got to sell our labor, you know, unless we organize to get more free time, which unions traditionally have done, actually, by the way, and workers' parties in other countries. But we're in a weak position here in the United States on that with some of the lowest vacation time. By the way, we're the longest work week now internationally. If you haven't been keeping up with that statistic, you might think if we did a trivia question, it's not trivial, but if we did a questionnaire, hey, what country has workers working the longest number of hours in a week? You might think back to the 80s or 90s and say Japan, or you might say China because of the way people are exploited there, workers are exploited there. But you're wrong. It's right here in the good old US of A, here in America, where we are working the longest work week in the world. Why? To make Jeff Bezos richer? I mean, there's enough wealth, quote unquote, in this country. It's more than enough to go around. But it's not going around. It's sitting at the top. And we're working more and more for less and less. That's the basic thing that's happening. Working more and more for less and less. And that is bad. That is not good for health. But so when you look around, you see a lot of overweight Americans. It's because they mess with our food and all that stuff that people tell you about food. I don't have time to get into it. You know, the additives and all that. And the price of food, and so fast food's cheaper, and the no time to cook, so fast food and all that, the stuff they put in fast food, that's all, a lot of that stuff is true. But it's also a fact, we don't have time to exercise. We don't have time to exercise. And people that I know some workers that exercise, I know working people that exercise, that becomes the main thing they do, right? So say you have an interest, say you have children, say you're getting involved in politics like I am, say you're doing something else with your free time, a hobby you really like. That takes the what little free time you might have, and I mean very little, and puts it there for me, it's the commute takes up a lot of free time and work and so on, like for a lot of people. But on top of that, what little free time you have, again, there's other things impinging on it. And you want to make exercise the main number one thing in your life, you can do that. I know someone that does that. I know a couple people that do that. They make time. They don't have much time, but they make time to exercise as their number one priority. And not to, you know, that's great. That's their choice. But they are spending all their free time on that. And I find that boring. I'm sorry. Or they're spending a lot of their free time, almost all, on that. And I think that's just really boring and unnecessary. And I know these are creative people. They would have other things to do if they weren't, if they didn't take that time, that extra time to exercise. If they had more time, then they could work exercise more into their schedule and still have time for other things. A lot of people have no time for exercise. And or very, very, very little. So if you want us to get out and walk, like the public service announcement said, Americans, if you want Americans to be healthier, if you have some sort of society-wide thing, if you're some rich liberal and you want to lecture people about how nice you live. I mean, I drive through Wellesley a lot based on my commute. It's complicated why I even do that. And I hate it because I see a lot of thin, older people running in Wellesley because they're so rich that they can afford to do that. They can make the leisure time to exercise. They can afford rich. There's a lot of gyms in Wellesley. They can afford the gym memberships, you know. I personally can't afford a gym membership. Can't do it. Even Planet Fitness. I went down there and looked at one. And I could have afforded it, at least at the moment they were doing this deal. They suck you in with cheap deals, and then they jack up the price on you. I'm well aware of that, and you should be aware of that too. But say I got in on a cheap deal and then maybe managed that for a few months, hopefully. And then that'd be good. That'd be a good thing. Except I walked into the place, because it's relatively cheap, it's completely packed, you know? So another drive to the place, another sort of commute in a life filled with commutes. And then plus the fighting for a place to like jog in place. I don't know. I mean, also where I live, no sidewalks, right? So you can't just go out and walk. There's a lot of problems. What I'm trying to get at here is a basic political point. Something like exercise, it seems to be a completely individual choice. It is not. It is completely tied into the economy, completely tied into society. And if you're not in a privileged position in terms of wealth and so on, if you don't live in certain places, your access to education, I'm sorry, no, that's true too, your access to places where you can exercise is extremely limited. You know, where there's a will, there's a way. If you make it the sole focus of every last piece of leisure time you have, you might be able to eke out some sort of regular exercise schedule, but it's extremely hard. And some of us can't afford the gyms. Some of us can't, a lot of us can't afford the time. A lot of us can't, don't live in places where it's easy to even just walk. You just have to learn, you have to understand that. So if you're really into that kind of, you know, lecturing, hectoring people, if you're in the medical profession, oh, you should all go out and exercise. And there's a lot of people in the medical profession that aren't elitist. I'm just saying, you know, like some doctors will say, you really need to exercise. I'll say, you really need to get me a shorter work week with no cut in pay. Can you do that? Can you get me a free gym pass to a really nice gym? Because I, you know, some of the lower end gyms are completely filled right now. Can you get me this or that? And I'm not expecting them to get me that. That has to be a part of a mass movement. I'm trying to raise awareness of things like public health. I'm certain there's a lot of people in public health. Public health, I've met socialists in public health, actually. I know they're there. It's not an individual decision-making thing as much as it is an ability, a societal ability to provide the infrastructure and the time for personal health. So, wow, that took up a lot of time on that. Getting back to the mentioning elections that have come up a bit in this discussion. I have this quote that someone named Lewis N. Project, who's active, he writes for Counterpunch, and he's active on the internet a lot, on Mark's Mail and stuff. He writes, if you're a Marxist, you must oppose, and that Marxist is synonymous for revolutionary socialist or sometimes communist or whatever, depending on how you define that stuff. If you're a Marxist, you must oppose capitalist parties, political parties. It was only with the Popular Front era that you had self-described Marxists urging support for capitalist parties. And what he's referring to then is the communist parties around the world, including the United States in the 1930s, came up with this idea of supporting liberal parties like the Democratic Party in the United States, which is sometimes liberal, sometimes not, but liberal parties And I mean that within the context of liberal being pro-capitalist. Sometimes it's becomes sort of indistinguishable from the Republican Party. Sometimes it is distinguishable from it. And so you had the Communist Party, which was growing rapidly in the 1930s in the United States, got up to 100,000 members, a lot of influence in the labor movement and so on. They decided to support the Democrats throughout most of the 30s and continued that. And then they lost, of course, membership. And other left groups, like a socialist group that's growing right now, Democratic Socialists of America, is supporting Democrats, sort of a popular front strategy. So there's this quote from way back in the beginning of the socialist movement by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, some of the two of the theoretical founders of socialism, and they say they said way back in this they were talking to a group called the Communist League in Europe, and they were giving a speech, and they said, quote, I forget which one was speaking, it might have been Marx, might have been both of them at different times, whatever, just one quote. Quote, even when there is no prospect of achieving their election, the workers must put up their own candidates to preserve their independence. I would add political independence there just to be clearer. But anyways, to gauge their own strength as workers, as a workers' movement, and to bring their revolutionary position and party standpoint to public attention. They must not be led astray by the empty phrases of the Democrats. Now, this is a small D Democrat, but it fits our situation. They must not be led astray by the empty phrases of the Democrats who will maintain that the workers' candidates will split the Democratic Party and offer the forces of reaction, meaning conservatives, the chance of victory, in meaning in elections. All such talk means, in the final analysis, is that the proletariat, meaning working people, are to be swindled. The progress which the Workers' Party will make by operating independently in this way is infinitely more important than the disadvantages resulting from the presence of a few reactionaries, again meaning conservatives, in the representative body. If the forces of democracy take decisive action against the conservatives to begin with, the reactionary influence or conservative influence in the election will have already been destroyed. And of course, it's not. But having independent workers' parties, you can bet there's going to be more resistance to people like Trump and also Democrats that are anti-worker and so on. There is a socialist, a straight-up socialist, running for re-election for a third time. So socialism can win in electoral contests here in the United States. This is in Seattle. We mentioned it on the show before. Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A. S-A-W-A-N-T last name, if you want to look her up. She's a member of Social Alternative who ran for election first, I think it was 2013, as an open socialist, as a member of Social Alternative. We had to sue, actually, the Seattle government, the state government in Washington, to get Social Alternative on the ballot. There's this big scam going in U.S. politics that a lot of people don't necessarily recognize, which is that terms like nonpartisan, where you have certain cities where you can't list your political affiliation, are really just there to keep usually the Democrats having sort of a one-party state situation where they control a big city council or control a state legislature. And that's a tool in their belts to make it so people can't punish the Democrats by voting for another party. Republicans like it too, because there's differences between Republicans and Democrats, but you know, there are certain things they agree on, and they both have an interest through this and through things like gerrymandering and so on. To gerrymandering is constructing weird voting maps in order to get certain votes, a vote result for your party or your candidate if you're a Democrat or Republican. And in Seattle, despite the nonpartisan rule, for it was able to be overcome, and Shama, next to Shama Sawant's name, was Socialist Alternative, and you had tens of thousands of people voting for Shama in the first election, which was citywide. Second election, based on a region within Seattle, and that was not her choosing. That was what they split up Seattle into regions and got rid of the citywide seats, as far as I remember. Shama Sawant won re-election in 2016, I think, and won it with more votes than the first time, and now it's a third time for re-election. Very tough time this time, because in the meantime, Sharma has Sawan, Social Alternative, and other progressives and socialists behind this campaign or with this campaign. These campaigns have won the first, they won the first $15 minimum wage law in the country for citywide. That was in Seattle in 2000, again, I think it was 14. Other things have been won. For example, a big new police headquarters was stopped by a campaign led by Sharma and others. There was a short-term tax on Amazon profits that got reversed by the Democrats, got scared when Bezos, it was initiated and led by Sharma, getting the Democrats, because it was such a popular thing, tax Amazon, this huge corporation, to get money for public housing and housing issues in Seattle, where there's a huge homelessness problem, partially, again, because of Amazon. And the Democrats went for it at first, and then they got scared the minute Bezos and others and people aiding Bezos attacked that tax, TAX, and then went back to voted it down. You know, 1 minute they voted for it, a couple months later they voted it down. Sharma, of course, kept the vote for the tax, and one other person on the city council did. All the rest, all Democrats, voted against continuing the tax. So she's in the, what that means is that Sharma Sawan, Social Terms, so they're in the, they're more even firmly in the sights of big business. They always were, there always was opposition, of course, from liberals, from conservatives, pro-capitalists along the whole spectrum. But now the top capitalists, like people like Bezos and so on, they're really, really into, business people are really, really into trying to stop a growing support for socialism electorally in Seattle, and I would say overall in many ways. So the re-election campaign has already started. It will happen in November of this year. So there was a re-election campaign launching party in March. Over 200 people showed up. And Sharma was quoted as saying, quote, "This is not about me as an individual. It never was. We have won victories again and again because thousands of working people, labor union members, LGBTQ people, renters, and socialists stood up against the bankrupt policies of the corporate establishment." So I urge you to look up Sharma Sawan. Look at the record there. Sharma's fought relentlessly, I'm quoting here, for working people in District 3 of Seattle, which also means taking a bold stand against the very billionaires who profit off low wages and sky-high rents in Seattle. This was a quote. I'm going to have to hurry along here and end the show soon. That's why I'm not reading everything about the re-election kickoff, send-off party, whatever you call it. But there's a lot of pictures that the thing I'm looking at of union leaders and others that stood up and spoke for Sharma. Let me just read one here. "If it wasn't for council member Sharma Sawan, we wouldn't even have known our building was being torn down. The developers just care about profits. What about us, the people?" Renee Holmes, Chateau apartment resident and activist, for example, because Sharma's and Social Determinant involved a lot of pro tenants' rights struggles, pro renter struggles. Quote, "For 6 years, we tried to change the racist Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, and no one responded. Council member Sharma Sawan responded in just a few hours when we reached out and took up the fight, because that is what her office is for, and in 6 months, we won." That's Matt Remley, co-founder of Mazaska Talks, and that is referring to, they have Indigenous Peoples Day. That struggle was led by Sharma and others out there, and that was won a couple of years ago, I believe. And then finally, council member Sharma Sawan is fundamentally an organizer, and she has made a lot of powerful enemies, like I was mentioning. But the best way to fight back against that is to have a lot of powerful allies, and that's what we are. David Parsons, UAW 4121 president, United Auto Workers. I'm not sure what workplace that is. So anyway, check out Sharma Sawan, running, a socialist, winning and running again for third time re-election in Seattle. Very quickly, as I mentioned in the intro to the show, there is still behind the scenes now, so the corporate media is not talking about it lately, there is pressure on Venezuela, sanctions, wrecking the economy there. We're not talking about Venezuela, by the way, because we think Venezuela is a socialist economy. It's not, never was, but under Chavez and now under Maduro, especially under Chavez in the beginning of Maduro's time in office, there was significant gains made in education, healthcare, food accessibility for the poor, for the working poor in Venezuela and for others, and all sorts of gains made in housing and so on. It wasn't, it was still a long way to go when Chavez passed away. Maduro took up the fight, and his, you know, people around him took up the fight. Maduro tried very hard, unfortunately, this is a bad thing actually, to appease U.S. demands, U.S. imperialism, and get rid of a lot of the demands, a lot of the, I'm sorry, progressive programs that existed in Venezuela. It did not appease any, it never does. Big business wants its hands on the oil reserves. The largest proven oil reserves in the world are in Venezuela. So even though it's fallen off the corporate media lately, I came across this article from Common Dreams, April 2nd, 2019, entitled Weak Journalism. New York Times fails to disclose op-ed writer's close family ties to Venezuelan opposition leader. Now, this is really interesting. I don't have time to get into all the details, but basically there was a video opinion piece published by the New York Times that was intended to drum support for U.S. involvement in Venezuela. But it failed to, the New York Times failed to say the author has ties to the opposition government. She claims Maduro's a dictator, even though he was elected many times, and American left are his patsies, quote unquote. And you know, all sorts of, calling Venezuela socialist and so on. And it's implied, though never outright stated, that the answer is the opposition leader, Juan Guaido, who's a puppet of U.S. Corporations and U.S. imperialism, Trump regime and all that. So here's the point of the story, though. What the video and the New York Times did not reveal is that Hausman's father, Harvard University economics professor Ricardo Hausman, currently serves as Guaido's envoy to the Inter-American Development Bank. And it's a position that if Guaido became president, would wield immense political and economic power. The omission was a focus of criticism from progressives. The elder Hausman's place in the Venezuelan shadow government is a conflict that should have never, that should have been made clear in his daughter's opinion video for the New York Times, implicitly arguing for American intervention to remove Maduro. Someone wrote in, Think Progress reporter wrote in, New York Times, very cool, she's being sarcastic, the New York Times, not to mention, you know, the fact that Joanna Hausman's dad is an economic advisor for Guaido. Ricardo Hausman's past in Venezuela should give Americans serious pause before taking him seriously. Anya Parampel argued in an early March article for Mint Press News, quote, Ricardo Hausman is much more than a prominent pundit. He's one of the West's leading pro-capitalist neoliberal economists who played an unsavory role during the 80s and 90s in devising policies that enabled the looting of Venezuela's economy by international capital and broke devastating social turmoil. And that his daughter is not an independent voice, but rather the failed child of Guaido's advisor, Ricardo Hausman, a man who neoliberalized, destroyed Venezuela's economy once before and wants to do it all over again. Apparently, Hausman works at Harvard as well. I think I saw that somewhere when I was reading this article in preparation for the show. Let's see. But I'm not finding that again here, so I'm not going to say that for sure. Maybe I skipped it. Anyway. Or maybe I already read it and forgot about it. Let's see. Anyway, I think he works for Harvard. Okay. Last but not least, and it's going to be the last thing we can get into today. We, again, left off that sort of macro look at, big picture look at unions in America, which is very important, and some very good information on that, but I'm going to have to save it till next time. But let's talk about a report that came out last year, and I referred to this earlier, United Nations report that there are 40 million in poverty in the U.S., which is the most unequal, here, our country, the most unequal developed nation. A study for the human rights, this is from UPI, United Press International, was also taken up by World News and U.S. News, UPI.com, blah, blah. Okay. Susan McFarland is the author. The 20-page report, okay, a study for human rights council, for the U.N. Human Rights Council, has concluded 40 million people in the United States live in poverty, and more than half of those live in extreme or absolute poverty. 40 million. The 20-page report by Philip Alston, UN Special Rapporteur, that's what it says, Rapporteur, on extreme poverty and human rights says U.S. policies benefit the rich and make poverty worse. The United States has the highest income inequality in the Western world. It's going to only be made worse by the massive new tax cuts overwhelmingly benefiting the wealthy. That's what we were talking about before with the lack of progressive taxation. That's one part of that. The report cites vast numbers of middle-class Americans perched on the edge, quote-unquote, with 40% of the adult population saying they would be unable to cover an unexpected $400 expense. I'm going to repeat that. The report cites vast numbers of middle-class Americans perched on the edge, quote-unquote, with 40% of the adult population saying they would be unable to cover an unexpected $400 expense. I share that. I was just complaining yesterday. I was actually yelling out loud to myself that why do these places that you have to pay things, they want it all at once. You can, a lot of times you can't negotiate like payment in increments. It's like, oh yeah, every pay period we get more money. No, we get the same amount. We have to budget, and budgeting means you can't have all the bills come in at one time. That must be paid in full. And yet that's how a lot of stuff works for like summer camps, for like daycare stuff, for like, you know, buying an emergency repair. A lot of stuff, they don't take partial payment. Sometimes they do. A lot of times they don't. And things can add up all of a sudden, hit you, and I'm supposed to come up with thousands of dollars, you know. And where's that going to come from? Don't have that in the bank, you know. Anyway, Austin, this author of the report from the UN, criticized the Trump administration for stigmatizing the poor. That means making the poor a target of derision and a target of being bad or something, and saying that those receiving government benefits are lazy and should be working. Well, guess what? The report found just 7% of benefit recipients in the United States are not working. Just 7%. Everyone that I know that's been on food stamps also worked really hard. All right. The statistics that are, for example, the statistics that are available show that the great majority of people who, for example, are on Medicaid are either working in full-time work, and around half of them, or they are in school. Wait a minute, how does that read? They're working in full-time work. That's around half of them. Or they are in school, or they're giving full-time care to others. Report criticized Trump's $1.5 trillion tax cut package. My taxes, for example, I got a lower return. My return was cut in half. That really hurt me and my family badly. Trumpo did that in his regime. With overwhelming benefits, his cuts overwhelming benefit the wealthy and worsen the situation for the poor. Quote, the share of the top 1% of the population in the United States has grown steadily in recent years. In relation to both wealth and income, the share of the bottom 90% has fallen in most of the past 25 years, and this tax reform will worsen the situation and ensure the United States remains the most unequal society in the developed world. The article ends with the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations basically criticizing the report, and why do they even bother to look at inequality in the United States? And there you have it. They're not on your side. The government, not on your side. Run by big business, run by the big corporations. We need a new political party for working people. Now, we're going to cut out a little early here because it takes time to shift over shows and takes time to do some paperwork and some things here that I have to do for the show. But thank you for listening. We're going to go out with a song I haven't really listened to. I hope it's good. If it's not, I'm going to switch over quickly to a tried and true artist that we put on the show a lot, the late, great Gil Scott-Heron. And which one of those should we do? I don't know. Let's see. The Get Out of the Ghetto Blues, maybe we'll try that. Yeah, okay. So thanks for listening to Social Alternative Radio. We'll be back in a couple weeks. We're on every other week, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Talking music from a working class Democratic Socialist perspective, and we hope you enjoyed the show, and we hope you will support any way you can, but especially don't cross the picket line if Stop Shop workers go on strike, but also help them out by finding out more about the strike. Check out United Food and Commercial Workers websites in New England area, and tell the company how you feel. You support the strikers 110%, like we do here at Social Alternative Radio. Thanks again for listening. Or the potential strikers, they're not on strike yet, but you support the Stop and Shop workers, whether they go on strike or not, and their contract struggle. You support that 110%. Yay. Okay. Thanks for listening. Bye.
This old town should have burned down in 1929. That's when we stood in line, waiting for our soup. swallowing our pride. This old town should have burned down in 1931, when the rain refused to come. Air filled up our bellies, dust filled up our lungs, and we thought our time had come. This old town was built by hand in the dust bowl of the motherland. There must be rock beneath the sand. This town still stands. This old town should have burned down in 1944, when the last men went to war. They came back different, if they came back at all. This old town should have burned down in 1956. That's when the twister hit, and all our hopes were buried beneath the barbs and bricks, and we almost called it quits. This old town was built by hand in the dust bowl of the motherland. There must be rock beneath the sand. I'll be damned. This town still stands. Somewhere in the distance, the city lights do shine. Sidewalks gleam with neon dreams that call from time to time. And when my children's children ask me why I didn't go, I'll say the heart of any town is the people that you know. And they'll always call you home. This old town was built by hand in the dust bowl of the motherland. There must be rock beneath the sand. Well, I'll be damned. This town still stands.
Ghetto. This is called the Get Out of the Ghetto Blues. Just cause they bus your kids to school. But you ain't got a thing to lose. You just got to get out of the ghetto blues.